Good morning. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear how thousands of miles of waterways across the US are threatened by contamination from different chemical sources. A new report is calling for major actions to protect them at the same time that the Trump administration is moving to weaken safeguards. Then we'll take a closer look at water contamination here along the Front Range. We'll hear about a lawsuit against Colorado-based meat processor JBS for polluting the South Platte River. On Resistance Radio this morning, we'll hear about artivism, or art as activism. We'll hear the voices of some artists from the Bioneers Front Range Eco Solutions Conference that took place this past weekend on the CU Boulder campus. We'll hear some actions happening on the Resistance Radio calendar. Then, after headlines from the BBC and a commentary from Jim Hightower, it's time for Poco in Boco. It's our monthly show, People of Colour in Boulder County. And today we'll hear from Jamal Gilmore of Boulder. He's the owner of the Brooklyn Barbershop, who has to move location due to rising rents in the city. We'll hear what it's like to be an African-American business owner in a community like Boulder. At 9 o'clock, it's media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Denver public school teachers took to picket lines this morning, beginning their first strike in 25 years. More than 2,000 of the system's 5,000 teachers have called into the district, KDVR reports, giving a good indication of how large the strike will be. A march is scheduled to take place from South High School to the intersection of Colfax and Spear, starting at about 9 a.m. this morning. Last week, Governor Jared Polis declined to intervene in the dispute, which meant that teachers could strike under state law. Their union voted overwhelmingly last month to walk out due to disagreements over compensation. After the governor's announcement, the teachers' union and the district held further bargaining sessions, which ended when the teachers walked out without success. Henry Roman, president of the Denver Classroom Teachers Association, said at a press conference early this morning that the teachers had tried to negotiate with the school district up until Saturday night.
We met for like more than 4 hours to discuss professional development. In Denver, we call it PDUs, professional development units. And it seemed like the conversation was going somewhere. We could wrap that up and get that finished off the table. And then on Saturday, we discussed again another 3 hours, only to get a counter-proposal from DPS that eliminated the concept of professional development units. So to us, that was a waste of time, really.
The union announced that they won't return to the bargaining table until Tuesday at the earliest. On Sunday evening, officials with the Denver School District announced that all schools will remain open, staffed by recently hired and continuing substitutes. 1,400 employees from the district's central offices will also be required to fill in. The only exception is for early child education, whose classes are all canceled for today and the remainder of the strike. Some teachers have said they cannot afford to go on strike because they can't afford not to get a paycheck, even though they agree with the union's goals. Some students in the school system are supporting teachers. Two seniors at South High will walk out of class today. One told 9 News that it is really disappointing to see the district losing so many educators just because of pay. A church in Denver will be supporting the striking teachers. KDVR reports that the Shorter Community African Methodist Episcopal Church plans to donate money that will keep teachers on their feet throughout the strike. Pastor Timothy Tyler said that his prayer is that the district leadership will solve this quickly so that everyone can get back to educating the children. In other news about schools, the State Board of Education will hear an appeal this week of the Boulder Valley School District's denial of a charter school's application. The organizers of the Ascent Classical Academy at Flatirons applied to open in August in eastern Boulder County, but the district first voted not to review the application, saying it was incomplete. At that time, the state board sided with the school and ordered Boulder Valley to review it, and the denial then followed. On Thursday, the state board will hear an appeal of that decision. The Daily Camera reports that the denial was based upon the school's proposed governance model, transparency, and a non-discrimination policy that doesn't include gender identity and expression. Colorado Democratic Senator Michael Bennett talked on television yesterday about his possible entry into the presidential race. Appearing on NBC's Meet the Press, Bennett said that he thinks there's room in the primary for a moderate candidate, citing his experience in business and as the head of the Denver school system. Bennett said that the Medicare for All proposal backed by other Democratic candidates seems like a bad opening offer. Instead, he pointed to his bill called Medicare X that allows a person to choose a public health care plan or keep their private insurance, whether offered through their employer or on the individual market. Bennett described Colorado as being one-third Democratic, one-third Republican, and one-third independent. But he said he didn't think the country is anywhere nearly as divided as Washington, D.C. On Saturday, the city of Denver held a clinic to assist people with low-level marijuana convictions get them expunged from their records. Now that recreational use of pot is legal, officials want people who have, for instance, a conviction for possessing less than an ounce to get a new start. The program is called Turnover New Leaf, and KDVR reports that Mayor Michael Hancock said no one should be prevented from getting a job or other opportunities for doing things in the past that are now legal. City Attorney Kristen Bronson said that the process is not difficult or complicated, and a person does not even need an attorney. The program can be accessed online at denvergov.org. In the weather today, it will be mostly sunny with patchy fog for about another hour, and the high about 36 and breezy. Tonight, the low around 17, and tomorrow sunny with the high about 46. Right now, it's about 15 degrees along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. Thousands of miles of waterways across the US are threatened by contamination from different chemical sources. A new report is calling for major actions to protect them as the Trump administration moves to weaken safeguards, H2O Radio reports.
The Trump administration is in the process of rolling back Obama-era safeguards on rivers, streams, and wetlands from hazardous and toxic chemicals. Public hearings on the proposed rules that would limit the extent of those protections are set for the end of February. So it's very timely that a new report released February 7th details how waterways are already threatened by industrial pollution and need more protection, not less. Environment America and Frontier Group took a year to produce the comprehensive study, and its sense of urgency is professed in its title, Accidents Waiting to Happen.
The reason that we thought of that title is that when we look at what happens when we take billions of pounds of toxic waste generated from all kinds of facilities like fracking waste ponds, or coal ash ponds, or toxic chemical storage facilities, and we put those billions of gallons of waste near our rivers, lakes, and streams, there are accidents waiting to happen.
That's John Rumpler of the Environment America Research and Policy Center and one of the authors of the report. The study focuses on five risky sources of contamination in the U.S., fracking, industrial facilities, coal ash from power plants, oil pipelines and trains, and animal waste from large-scale farms. All contain massive amounts of pollutants and are often located near bodies of water.
And so we took a look at these facilities and documented some of the damage that they've already done, especially when there's flooding or hurricanes or explosions and so forth. And, you know, as a word of caution, like, here's how we can prevent these problems in the future.
The report shows that every area of the country has its particular risks. For instance, Minnesota has hog farm lagoons. New Jersey has high concentrations of toxic chemical facilities. And in North Dakota, there are a lot of oil pipelines that can rupture and trains that could derail. The report goes into detail about accidents that have already occurred, such as spills from coal ash ponds in Tennessee and pipeline leaks in California. With fracking, for instance, spills of highly contaminated wastewater pits near rivers and other bodies are common and has happened in Colorado and Pennsylvania, among other states. Given that there are 400,000 miles of oil pipelines across the country and 140,000 miles of train tracks that carry crude, and that both are often located alongside or across waterways, the report warns that the past is prologue and future disasters are, well, accidents waiting to happen.
I think we should just take a step back and ask ourselves, does it really make sense for us to be producing billions of pounds of toxic waste in the first place.
The path Rumpler and his team are recommending seems similar to that of fighting climate change. Rumpler says that we have the capacity to move to 100% clean, renewable energy. And when that occurs, we won't need oil trains and pipelines, coal ash-producing power plants, or fracking waste pits. The same goes for large-scale manure-producing hog and dairy farms.
We need to move towards more sustainable agricultural operations, so we won't even have these manure waste pits to begin with.
In the meantime, the study recommends against locating any new hazardous waste facilities right next to water sources. They also urge stronger enforcement of the laws already in place and definitely not rolling back any part of the Clean Water Act. Rumpler thinks that most Americans assume that any waterways they care about are under protection of the Clean Water Act, and if a polluter dumps contaminants into a river, the federal government will hold them accountable. But he says that won't happen under the Trump administration's plans to strip protections from thousands of streams and millions of acres of wetlands. We can and should do better, he says.
We absolutely can do this. This is not a technical question. This is not a scientific question. This is a matter of the public interest and political will. And I know that we can harness the energy and ingenuity of this nation to ensure that we keep our waterways clean and prevent these toxic hazards.
Rumpler says that for people concerned about the plans to repeal the Obama administration's clean water rule and replace it with what he calls a dirty water rule, they should send their feedback to the EPA. The agency has not yet opened the comment period, but a link, when it is, can be found at our website, h2oradio.org. From Denver, I'm Jamie Sudler.
And in more local water contamination news, problems continue for the world's largest meat processing company. You might recall JBS, a Brazilian-based meat packer that has their headquarters for the US right here in Greeley. Well, now they're facing a lawsuit by a contingent of community groups over violations of the Clean Water Act. Neil Levine is the Colorado attorney chosen to represent the various different organizations suing JBS. He spoke with KGNU's Robin Ryan.
If I understand what I've read correctly, meat processing environments are permitted to dispose of wastewater under a certain set of terms and conditions that impose limits on the amount of the waste, and your clients contend JBS exceeds those limits routinely. What's in the waste, and what do you find most alarming in terms of potential impact?
Well, the company and the state negotiated a permit back in 2002, and it recognized that the majority of the waste were sort of salts, chlorine, ammonia, and those salts had to be limited in terms of how much were going to be disposed of into the state's waterways. The reality is that since at least 2014, the company has violated those limits for discharges. And the state has known about that and has tried to work with the company to fix the problem. There's no doubt that there is a problem at the site, and the company acknowledges this, and the state has given the company time to come up with solutions and put them on a series of schedules. And despite that, we still have exceedances of the permit limits that the company and the state had originally negotiated.
That's not so uncommon from what I was able to understand. According to a recent report issued by the Environmental Integrity Project, focused on water pollution from slaughterhouses, found roughly 3/4 of the meat processing industry in the United States, they're exceeding the permit limits. Do you think the regulatory framework that governs this industry is effective? And if not, where do you see the greatest potential for policy reform? How do you put a public's mind at ease when they sit down to dinner or decide to go for a river swim?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. There's a systemic problem with the industry in terms of how do they dispose of animal waste. And as you referenced the report that came out within the last 6 months or so, people should be aware of the problem. It's not just the fact that there's recalls of beef when the FDA finds too much E. coli in processed meat. There's also a secondary problem, which is how do the companies dispose of their waste? And this problem is not particular to Colorado. If you look at that report, it's mostly Midwestern states, sort of the beef-producing states throughout the country that have been violating their permits. And depending upon the state, each state sort of treats these problems differently. They each have their discretion on when and when not to enforce permit violations. But I suppose what you've seen in that report is that the common thread is that state agencies who have been delegated the authority from EPA to enforce water quality standards and water quality permits are not taking that responsibility seriously enough to prevent pollution in our rivers and streams and waterways.
I believe it's a provision in the Clean Water Act that enables citizen groups like Food and Water Watch or the Center for Biological Diversity, who it's my understanding they are your clients in this case.
Correct.
The CWA makes it possible for them to take legal action against entities who fail to act as proper stewards of environmental quality at a federal level. Who are the oversight authorities at the state level, and has their position on this firm shifted at all in the wake of the 12 million pounds of beef that had to be recalled by this company late last year?
Well, the Federal Clean Water Act allows the Environmental Protection Agency to delegate oversight of the permitting program to the state, and that is what happened for Colorado. And so Colorado is essentially the permit giver and the permit enforcer with some EPA oversight. When EPA and the state, in a scenario like this, have decided to take a different route in terms of compliance, in other words, they are not taking the steps to ensure compliance, that's when citizens and organizations like the ones you mentioned that I'm representing have the opportunity to sort of step into the enforcement shoes of the state and EPA and provide that mechanisms to enforce the law. And that's what it's looking like could happen here after 60 days. That 60-day period is sort of twofold in its purpose. One is to see if the company is going to figure out a way to demonstrate future compliance with its permit. And second is for the state to figure out if they're going to do anything to ensure the company will comply with its permit limits. And so it's going to be after that 60-day period where we'll have the opportunity to go to federal court and file a civil enforcement action. The Clean Water Act, which is the law that governs here, has its own penalty provisions, and they're imposed a set figure, I think it's around $50,000 for each violation per day. And that's the provision that would be in effect when and if we file our lawsuit after the 60-day notice period runs.
You kind of answered in advance my last question. That was simply, what's next?
I think we're in a waiting period now. The notice letter was submitted on January 31st. It was sent out that day. And depending upon what happens over the next 60 days, we'll be looking to file our complaint in federal court in Colorado. In some sense, the goal is to resolve the matter as quickly and as painlessly as possible for all parties involved. But this industry, as you've noted earlier about how they operate throughout the country, it's unclear if they're willing to take the measures necessary. I mean, they've balked at the opportunity to do so over the last 4 years. So whether they'll change their tune over the next 60 days, I suppose one could be dubious about that, but we'll just have to wait and see.
And I did want to mention the fact that the habitats affected by this particular plant include homes for at least two endangered species.
Yeah, that's going to be because the discharges enter the South Platte as the river heads northeast toward Nebraska, and that is where you'll find the river provides the habitat and the homes, as you mentioned, for two endangered species. So depending upon the impact of the pollution and the volume of pollution, the activities that occur at the JBS wastewater facility could impact those critters.
I've been talking with Neil Levine. He is an attorney at Public Justice. For more information, you can visit their website at publicjustice.net. For KGNU, this is Robin Ryan.
And it's time now for Resistance Radio. And now we'll take a look at art as resistance. This past weekend, the 16th annual Front Range Eco-Social Solutions, or Bioneers Conference, took place on the CU Boulder campus. It featured local and national leaders in sustainability, environmental and social justice issues. KGNU's Rosanna Longo-Better caught up with some panellists who spoke about art as activism, or artivism. We'll hear first from Ryan Fu, who is an activator and an education director with various organizations, art-based organizations around Denver. He produces with the Black Actors Guild in Denver, and he also teaches with the group Conscious Creatives. Rosanna asked Ryan what it's like to be an artist these days, and particularly as the Eco Solutions Conference was taking place at CU, what it's like for art students.
I dropped out of college after my first year, and I think that young people, especially artists, do that because we're also told, sort of jokingly, that we're not supposed to get degrees in arts, right? That if you get a degree in art, you're not going to get a job out. So I think a lot of us figure, well, why even go to college? And also just that the academic environment isn't conducive to creative people. It's just not. It's not meant to be. And so it's natural we drop out. And it's natural that there's also other successes that we forge outside of it because we're creative and we make them. So
please speak to me about the spaces that you have been able to bring create, the platforms that you have been able, the spaces that you have been able to give to people of color.
Sure. So the first is the Atlas Theater, which I helped build with the Black Actors Guild back in 2014. I mean, that's still open. The Pod Space is a recording studio that I run down in Five Points, and that's open to the community several days of the month for free. It's a DIY venue, so people just walk in and do their thing. There's tons of stages I've built that are actual stages, you know, various festivals and street stages and things like that. Kind of hard to narrow it down, but there are lots.
It's a way of artivism. Can you speak to that word and give us some maybe hope that this will make a change?
Yeah, well, I think you can find it in the modern media. You don't have to look too far out of pop culture to see how artivism is impacting things. I'm Sorry to Bother You did really well, and that was a movie that was purely about sort of like code switching and what it means to be black in a white marketing world, advertising, telecommunications world. That did really well, right? And so it's no longer just like the fringe artists are doing weird stuff and it gets attention. It's becoming mainstream. People really care about this stuff. And as you know, when it comes to capitalism, you know, where the money goes, the influence goes. So it's really awesome to see that kind of stuff coming up. It's awesome to see Black Panther and all the cool new movies coming out that are about people of color and that are about new solutions, or at least about addressing problems that are obvious that exist. So
my name is Franklin Cruz. I'm a Denver artist and scientist, and I was here by Nears on the Artivist panel, and an interesting occasion happened. We were talking about how to frame our conversations so that we don't immediately push people into zones where they're overly stretched out of their emotions or comforts, and they shut down before we even get to talk to them. And so specifically, we're talking about how not labeling the climate crisis as a crisis, because that's one of the words that pushes people far too out of their comfort zones, and they shut down and will not listen to you. And so it's not an effective conversation. One of the audience members pushed back, saying that essentially we don't need to soften things. We need to address things as they are. Otherwise, we're not going to get the urgency behind the movement. And so it was, for me, a calling to respond to her with the same tactics that I was saying to use, which was I addressed how if you use a really harsh tone and something that's strong in the vocals, then people will immediately shut down because they're so concerned about why you're being so harsh. They will not listen to what you're actually saying because your tone is too harsh. And then I showed the audience member, if you modulate your voice using body posture, using gestures, how many more people can become intrigued by what you're saying, because it is not so harsh. It is actually inviting, and it is actually framing a conversation they feel included in, and they feel like they're not going to be stretched out of their comfort zone, but they will be pushed into a growing zone, right? And so not overly stretched. And it was just an occasion where it was a practice of utilizing the practice in the moment.
How can you connect art and science?
So for me, I think one of the biggest things we pulled from the Artivist panel was that art is the way we relate to people. Art is humanistic because for me, all cultures have art. All cultures have a poet, all cultures have a singer, all cultures have a dancer, and they take different forms and they talk about different things and they're different structures, but they're all artists. And so if you are trying to bridge gaps from diversity and inclusion and equity, utilizing art is the best way because it's universal.
Some of the voices of artists or artivists who took part in this past weekend's Front Range Eco-Social Solutions Conference on the CU Boulder campus, speaking there with KGNU's Rosanna Longo-Better. It is 8:28. It's time now for the Resistance Radio Calendar.
Now we got a revolution, 'cause I see the face of things to come.
On Wednesday, February 13th, from 6 p.m., there will be the 10th annual Love Knows No Ban and No Walls Vigil. It takes place outside of the GEO Immigrant Detention Centre in Aurora. That's on Oakland Street. And it's hosted by the American Friends Service Committee and the Colorado People's Alliance. The event will include music and poetry from Celeste Martinez and Andrea Savage. And a Facebook Live feed will be available just after 6 o'clock. The event calls on the public to learn and understand what toll immigration detention takes on families and communities who are separated. On Saturday, February 16th, Still Coming Home, Conversations about the Experience of War. It takes place at the Longmont Public Library from 10 a.m. and it's in collaboration with Denver Veterans Writers Workshop. And you can hear directly from veterans speaking about their experience. Just to communicate. Also, every Saturday at 1 p.m., Longmont Leads with Love Vigil takes place at Main Street and 6th Avenue. You can find out more information about those events and others online at our Resistance Radio calendar. Just go to news.kgnu.org and click on Resistance Radio.